The next case this morning is 519-0372, People versus McGauley. Arguing for the defendant is Carolyn Clarquist. Arguing for the state is Trent Marshall. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings.
Counsel for the appellant, please state your name and you may proceed.
Good morning, your honors, counsel for the state. My name is Carolyn Clarquist and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Stephen McGauley. This court should grant Mr. McGauley a new trial because the trial court committed 2 reversible errors that violated McGauley's constitutional right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. First, McGauley was prejudiced when the trial court denied his motion to sever the first degree murder and Class A misdemeanor battery charges, which allowed the jury to then hear damaging propensity evidence that would not be otherwise admissible as to the first degree murder charge alone. It compounded the error when it failed to properly instruct the jury at the close of evidence about the proper limited use of the propensity evidence. Second, the trial court also denied Mr. McGauley a fair trial when it denied his motion for mistrial without taking any remedial action whatsoever after the jury saw the state's star witness fall off the witness stand, injure his head, and be taken away in a stretcher. Turning to the first issue, severance. Severance should be granted and separate trials ordered if it appears the defendant is prejudiced by joinder of separate charges. That's exactly what happened in this case. Mr. McGauley was charged with first-degree murder of his friend, Stephen Flack, and also a separate Class A misdemeanor battery of his wife. Prior to trial, counsel filed a severance motion, and he argued correctly so, that as a consequence of joining the charges, the state was then allowed, by virtue of the domestic battery charge, to present prior evidence of domestic violence. Now, the reason that's prejudicial and should not have been admitted, because had the cases been severed, the jury would have only heard the evidence as to the first degree murder charge. The state would have been put to no disadvantage had the trial court granted the severance motion, allowed that jury to hear the evidence with regard to the first degree murder, and then separately hear the prior incidents of domestic violence in a separate bench trial for the Class A misdemeanor. The parties even could have stipulated to that evidence. But regardless, it's longstanding in our common law that propensity evidence can be particularly damaging to a defendant because the jury may be more likely to convict him because he thinks he's a bad person deserving of punishment. In this case, that's exactly what happened. The state knew ahead of time that Mr. McGauley was going to raise self-defense. That put his credibility into question because he would have to testify to his self-defense claim. In this case, when Mrs. McGauley testified about the prior incidents of domestic violence, the jury did receive a limited instruction, telling it properly so that that evidence could only be heard with regard to the domestic battery charge. Great, that's fine. However, during closing argument, the state told the jury that, and this was after there was an objection from defense counsel when the state started to make this argument, it told the jury that you're gonna get a jury instruction. It's gonna say that the evidence of the other domestics have been received on the issue of defendant's propensity. They can be considered by you. They show the defendant acts that way. Then next, we have the jury instructed. They do not get the limiting instruction. They are not told that the propensity evidence can only be considered to the separate domestic battery charge. Instead, what they do get is an instruction saying that the evidence has been received, that the defendant has been involved in an offense other than those charged. I would ask the court to take note of that. Those charged, that is a plural. He's been charged with 2 criminal offenses that are before the jury. And then the fact that the jury was confused by all this is clear from the jury note that it sent out. During its deliberations, they asked specifically about the prior incidents of domestic violence, saying, do we combine the previous incidents alluded to as part of the charge, or were the previous incidents just used as an example of previous behavior and not part of the current domestic battery charge? And the judge actually circles that latter part. to be used as examples of previous behavior, not part of the domestic battery charge. Well, that kind of tracks back to the state's closing argument. Defendant acts that way. Here, examples of previous behavior. That's what the jury's asking about. And this would have been the perfect opportunity for the trial judge to say, hold on, we got to make sure the jury's properly instructed. It could have given the eliminating instruction at this juncture, and it should have. It absolutely should have. We raised a separate argument that counsel was ineffective for not asking this. And in both instances, prejudice has occurred through the trial court and through trial counsel. And the reason for that is because we do not know that the jury convicted Mr. McCauley based on the applicable law to each separate charge. The Second District Appellate Court, their 2013 decision in Johnson is right on point. The same two errors that occurred in this case occurred in Johnson. And the court in that case held, as this court should do here, that there was an erroneous jury instruction, such as there is in this case, that being that the modified 3.14 the jury was given was not accurate, did not limit its use of the domestic violence prior incidents. And there, we don't know that as a consequence of the improper joinder and the faulty jury instruction, this has caused a serious risk that that Mr. McCauley could have been incorrectly convicted because the jury did not understand the applicable law. The confluence of errors here are the same that happened in Johnson, and actually much worse to the extent that here we had a defense counsel, you know, pleading. If you go back and look at the hearing from the severance motion, he's very clear. He's saying this is a way that of providing a backdoor method by which the state can try and subvert the purpose of evidence rule 404B, which is the prohibition of other crimes evidence. As I mentioned, the state was at no disadvantage to have these cases severed. Who was at a disadvantage by having him join Mr. McCauley, because he's going to testify. And by that point, the jury has already heard his wife testify to the prior incidents of domestic violence, none of which would have been admissible to the first degree murder charge alone. So for those reasons, because there was an affirmative misstatement of the law when the jury was fully instructed, not given the limiting instruction that the prior incidents, the propensity evidence, can only be used with regard to the misdemeanor domestic battery charge. This is reversible error. McCauley has been denied a fair trial by an impartial jury that was correctly instructed on the law. Turning to the second issue, the trial court also erred when it failed to grant a mistrial. This was the issue here was the state's only witness to the shooting of Mr. Flack was during cross-examination, is getting impeached. He testifies on direct that, you know, no aggression from the victim in the case. Keep in mind that Mr. McCauley has raised self-defense. And then during cross-examination, which by all accounts was very vigorous, that was never disputed on the record below, he's getting impeached with his initial statements to the police, during which he told the police that it was actually Mr. Flack who beat Mr. McCauley initially. And we know that he had injury, McCauley, because there were photographs introduced at trial that show that he had injury to his face. So here we go. He's now being challenged and impeached with those statements on cross-examination. And then what happens is he has what's called a violent seizure. He collapses, strikes his head on the desk, then the concrete floor adjacent to the jury box in full sight of the jurors. He gasped, seized, twitched, gurgled, and spasmed for several minutes before the jury's removed, and then he's taken out on a stretcher. He comes back almost a week later, after which, you know, counsel had moved for a mistrial saying, Judge, please, at least at a minimum, and the state did agree to this below. They don't now on appeal, but they had asked, you know, at least for some curative instruction. Counsel also asked that the jury be questioned. The trial court just outright dismissed it, said, well, they're not prejudiced. And the question here that this court, how can we answer that? The judge didn't do his duty and at least ask the jury, query them. We have to keep in mind the jury is citizens from Madison County. You know, it might be routine for the trial judge to see this sort of traumatic event, but certainly not for these jurors, especially where they then see this witness. Keep in mind the only witness for the state to testify that McCauley shot
But didn't he get
the
the
victim.
jury out of the room quickly?
He did get the jury out of the room quickly. But the concern here is that, and I cited a lot of cases in my brief, where the motion for mistrial denial was upheld. But the reason for that, and you can look at each one, there was some questioning of the jurors about the incident at issue. No such questioning was done here. It was just the trial court's subjective determination that there is no sympathy. And then, you know,
but
then
he
we
was
have
there, and it's an abuse of discretion standard, isn't it?
That's right. It is an
it
abuse
is an
of
abuse
discretion.
Standard,
it,
right?
It is. And we think that the lack of using any discretion, which is what the judge here is an abuse of discretion. He's relying on his subjective opinion about the jury's impressions. And the least he could have done is given them IPI 101, just reminding them neither sympathy or prejudice should influence you, but instead he doesn't. And then the first thing they hear when Kibbins resumes testifying a week later is that I'm here against doctor's orders. And then in closing argument, they hear the state refer to defense counsel making Kibbins look like a fool, call him a liar. There's a bit of ridicule there. So, you know, Mr. McCauley, again, he's entitled to an impartial jury. That did not happen here for the two reasons that I put forth today. And I see I'm out of time. Does the court have any questions?
Questions, Justice Vaughn?
No questions.
Justice Welch?
No questions.
Thank you.
You'll have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for Appellee, please state your name and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Trent Marshall for the state. May it please the court, Ms. Clarquist. With respect to the motion to sever, it states position that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in determining that the domestic battery, which immediately preceded and prompted the events that led to the murder, was part of the same comprehensive transaction for purposes of Section 111-4A, and that even assuming otherwise, the failure to sever was harmless. With respect to the fact that the jury was not twice given a limiting instruction with respect to the state's 115-7.4 evidence, the state would emphasize that when the evidence of the two prior domestics was admitted, the jury was contemporaneously instructed that the prior acts were only relevant to the domestic violence charge. And the jury's note later showed that it appropriately limited its consideration of the prior acts to that charge. Under the circumstances, the defendant's unable to establish error or plain error. At this point, I would offer this cite, People versus Hudson, 2023, Illap First, 192519, paragraph 57. And it's one of several cases that I think cites People versus White, a Supreme Court decision, for the general proposition that if a defendant is unable to demonstrate first prong plain error, he is unable to demonstrate prejudice for the purposes of Strickland. As defense counsel correctly notes in her reply brief at 11 and 12, pages 11 and 12, I neglected to include a statement of that effect in my brief, and I apologize for the oversight. As for the motion for the mistrial, the trial court allowed counsel to make his record as to what counsel claimed happened. Trial court simply disagreed with counsel's representation of what had occurred. Delving further into it, questioning the jurors about something that the trial court determined it had not seen might have drawn undue attention to it and caused further problems. Given that it is an abuse of discretion standard and the court was in the superior position to make these determinations as to what occurred and as to its potential effect, this court should find no abuse of discretion. Now, I would lastly like to address the notion that the evidence was closely balanced. It just didn't come down to Kibbins' testimony versus the defendant's. Leah, the victim's wife, she was the only one that was sober, I think. And she corroborated Kibbins' testimony in several respects. There was a defense witness, and I apologize again, I should have developed this further in my opening brief, but there was a defense witness named Jamie Souter. And as the defendant notes in the brief at page 7, she testified that there was continuous yelling and cussing prior to hearing 5 quick gunshots. The state explored this The state went into this during the trial. That's kind of an incomplete and inaccurate summary. She had told a Detective Kolker, I believe, a few days after the incident, and her prior statement was admissible pursuant to 115-10.1. And the state clarified during its cross-examination and its recross that what she actually saw and heard was she heard a lot of yelling and screaming. She walked down. She saw Leah at the car. Then she saw the victim walk out. He didn't appear agitated. He was smoking a cigarette, came out to talk to Leah. Miss Suter started walking as the victim started walking back towards the house. And then she said it was approximately 70 feet, I think, in 20 seconds. She heard complete silence, and then she heard gunshots. And what that effectively established was, it corroborates Kibben's account of what he said happened. Basically, the defendant just walked out and started blasting. And as the state argued below in its closing, Souter's testimony demonstrated that the events the defendant described did not happen and could not have happened in such a short time frame. Beyond that, Mary's statements as excited utterances on the 911 call and immediately at the scene were extremely powerful. She said things such as, "My husband killed my best friend. My husband's in a lot of trouble. I can't believe he did it. He needs to go to jail." She wasn't going to protect him. She would cooperate and testify. She later changed her stories and backed away from all that, and perhaps understandable on her part, but the evidence was still there, and it was powerful evidence. And then if we look at the defendant's account in and of itself, a common sense analysis, state's position, it's fairly unrealistic, otherwise questionable, and even if accepted, his testimony demonstrated he was not in danger when he returned outside to the gun, and he later admitted that things could have gone differently. This is just a tragic situation all the way around. And I would lastly note, it's not dispositive of anything, but I would just cite it as a further indication that the evidence was not close at all. It was an 8-day jury trial. The jury deliberated less than 3 hours, I think, before finding the defendant guilty on both counts. And if there aren't any questions at this point, I would just ask that your honors affirm the defendant's convictions.
Any questions, Justice Vaughn?
No questions, thank you.
Justice Welch.
No questions.
All right, thank you for your time, your honors.
You may proceed.
Your honors, as the state acknowledges, they didn't make these arguments fleshed out in their brief. To the extent I'm happy to respond to them here, this is not a sufficiency challenge. The question here is whether Mr. McCauley was denied a right to a fair trial before an impartial jury. The severance statute is very clear. The prejudice component, the state has yet to answer the question of how the use of the domestic violence prior incidents could not prejudice Mr. McCauley. When these cases could have been severed, they could have presented the exact same evidence as to the domestic battery charge. They're at no disadvantage whatsoever. They could present their case in exactly the same way without the jury also being tasked about the domestic battery charge, which that was a conduit for which the state was able to bring in the prior domestic violence incidents. Our legislature has been very careful and specific about when propensity evidence can be used, and that's because of the domestic violence. We haven't contested that those priors could come in with respect to the sole charge of domestic battery. But the problem is when you join these charges, it allows the jury, who does not sit in a vacuum and who is not properly instructed days after they got the only limiting instruction on the use of that evidence. That's the harm here. This is not a sufficiency challenge. The error here is not harmless. This is exactly why we have severance. If severance is not appropriate in this case, I'm not sure what case it would be appropriate in. As I said, the judge could have had there could have been a separate bench trial easy on this. And that's not what happened. And it's clear that, this is a misdemeanor charge. Why is the state so insistent on charging with the first degree murder? That charge has a sentencing range of 45 to natural life because it involved a firearm. So to that extent, you know, as counsel said below, it was pretty clear what's going on here. And what it did is compromised Mr. McCauley's right to a fair trial. And I think Johnson is on point completely with that. And I asked you to follow that. I also asked you to look back at your case, People versus Patterson, which you issued 30 years ago. And in that case, you said that, you know, that the defendant has to get a fair trial and that, here it is. Trial court is entitled to substantial discretion when deciding whether to sever charges. That discretion is to be exercised so as to prevent injustice. Prevent injustice. That's not what happened here. Not at all. Similarly, you know, when the state talks about the evidence, which they really didn't do in their brief, absolutely, McCauley, you know, he said he killed his friend. Keep in mind, these are lay people. He shot someone. You know, it's fair to think he might be in trouble for doing that, but he did present a self-defense claim. He testified to that. His credibility was at issue on that, which is exactly why the propensity evidence was particularly damaging in this case, especially where the jury is not properly instructed. We can't be confident that this is a reliable verdict that was based on the applicable law. This is shown by the instruction that was given and the fact that the jury sent out this note. Also by the state's own closing evidence. They received the limiting instruction one time, 7 days before the close of evidence, when they're fully instructed, during which, you know, the star witness who, when the state talks about some of the participants here changing their story, well, so did he. He initially looked at his prior statements to the police at the scene of the offense. And then 2 days later, I believe, he basically said that the victim in the case was attacking Mr. McCauley. So, you know, the state says, well, Mary changed her story. So did their only witness to the offense. We cited the neighbor in our brief. We think her testimony supports the fact the victim went back into the house, which McCauley testified had said he had asked him to leave. Just one other point on this. Again, the jury, you know, saw this traumatic event. It's not commonplace. I think anyone, you know, here today, if they saw someone have a violent seizure, would have some effect. All that we were asking for is that there be some inquiry, or at least at a minimum, curative instruction and a reminder. The judge did nothing here. Nothing. He didn't inquire. He just dismissed and said, we spent too much time on that, on this issue. That's what he said. He also did not weigh prejudice at all with regard to the severance motion. That's clear. If you go back and look at the transcript, no mention of how joinder triggered the admission of the prior propensity evidence. And with that, I would ask, for the reasons stated today and in my brief and reply brief, that you reverse and remand for separate trials on these two offenses.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take the matter in this case under advisement and issue its decision in due course.